Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Van Maren Show. Today I'm going to be talking to Ben Scallon, the Irish journalist, presenter, and commentator. Any of you who follow Irish politics should be following his work, and you should be going over to gripped.ie to find out what's actually going on in the culture, because if you read the establishment media, of course, you're going to get a very specifically curated set of facts. Gripped was actually founded in the wake of the Irish abortion referendum in 2018, when a group of Irish conservatives recognized the fact that it was almost impossible to get an alternative narrative out in the media to have incredibly important stories covered and covered honestly and fairly in the establishment press. And Gripped has really been a meteor on the Irish journalism scene since its founding. And Ben is one of the rising stars over at Gripped. And I've been wanting to talk to him ever since the phenomenal referendum results in Ireland. The two constitutional amendments that were put to the public were voted down by staggering margins in what is the first major rebuke to the progressive establishment in a publicly held referendum. Because, of course, tragically, in 2018, the public voted to remove the Eighth Amendment to the Constitution, which protected preborn life in the womb. Similar results were returned for the redefinition of marriage and for divorce. And so really, this has sent shockwaves not only around Ireland, but around the Western world, because Ireland seemed to be plunging forward on the path to progressivism, very similarly to how Canada was. And now suddenly the voters said no. The voters said enough. And what does this all mean? It's incredibly encouraging. And so this is my conversation with Ben about what happened in Ireland, what it all means, and why we should be encouraged by it. So yeah, just to start off, maybe explain to all of our non-Irish listeners what the significance of the two referendums really were.
Yeah, so just to briefly explain what the referendums were about, they were a progressive attempt by the government to rewrite the Irish Constitution in two significant ways. First of all, we have this amendment within the Irish Constitution, which outlines the importance of women's contribution to home life. So I'm paraphrasing here, but effectively what it says is that women do incredibly important work to society as housewives, as mothers, and that role should be honored and respected and protected, and that the government should try its best and endeavor to make sure that women aren't forced out of the home by economic necessity to work if they don't want to. So it's, ironically, if I can borrow a phrase, it's actually pro-choice. What it's saying is that women should have the option to stay at home if they want to. But liberals and the left and the government have argued that this is a kind of a sexist, outdated, archaic piece of text, because what it's effectively doing is relegating women to a domestic role, or saying that women need to stay in the kitchen or something, which is absolutely not what it's saying. And the Supreme Court has been clear that that's not what it says. And that's the argument that they put forward. Then the other piece of text that they wanted to change in the Irish Constitution was the text currently says that the family is based on the institution of marriage, and that the government should defend the family unit. And they were saying that this isn't inclusive because there's all kinds of people who are families who aren't married, and so therefore it's discriminatory against them. And so we should say that the family is based on marriage or any other durable relationship. Now, of course, that's so vague and ambiguous that it could mean almost anything. Yes, was the argument of some people. What is a durable relationship? And it would open up all kinds of legal consequences for inheritance law, tax law, even where the government said immigration law when it comes to family reunification and things of that nature. So it would have just been a total legal quagmire. And so effectively, the long and short of it is the Irish people, in their infinite wisdom, rejected both of these proposed changes by an overwhelming majority, probably about 70% between the two proposals. And this was a landslide defeat for the government, which they really weren't expecting, because for so many years in Ireland, changes like this, sort of liberal changes, I mean, this one was held on International Women's Day. So you think, oh, it's a kind of a feminist issue and it's on one of the sacred holy days of progressivism. So, of course, we're going to walk it. It's not going to be a problem. And then all of a sudden it blew up in their face. And so they were shocked by it. Pretty much the whole media landscape who was behind it were shocked by it. The NGOs, the opposition parties who backed it. And it's been a real upset, I think, in Irish political terms that they really never saw coming.
So there's a lot there that I want to get into. But, you know, their cockiness probably comes from the fact that, as you kind of mentioned, right, they brought in the redefinition of marriage, divorce, and then most famously abortion in 2018, which was a real watershed moment in modern Irish history, hands down. And those of the listeners who are familiar with both of us will know we were both on a speaking tour a couple of years back in Ireland on the revival of the pro-life movement. And the news organization you work for, Gripped, was actually created in response to that, to the fact that, you know, during the abortion referendum, the progressive tilt of the media became so clear that it was clear the majority of Irish people didn't have a voice in the mainstream press. So what is your sense of this result? Like, I was actually having a good time on Twitter for the first time in a long time. Seeing the margins in some of the areas it's actually staggering. Like, I struggle to think of another electoral result that was so lopsided and such a rebuke to those who put the question to the public to begin with. So what's your sense of what this means? Is this, you know, the Irish people saying sort of thus far, no further, like, you know, we were fine with the redefinition of marriage because we don't really care what people do. You know, we bought the idea that some abortion was necessary because of the lies about Savita Halappanavar. But this is kind of where it ends, or is this a rebuke of the elites that we shouldn't read too much into with regards to the specific result? What's your sense of what the macro picture is?
Well, yeah, you're right that some of the margins were astonishing. I've been saying to people, it was almost like North Korea numbers, where some working class areas in Dublin were voting no to this proposal, but to the tune of 96%. And I don't think that you can contain this or say, as some people would like to say, that, well, this was just a rejection of this specific proposal. You know, people didn't like what we were offering in this specific instance. But as the equality minister told me when I was asking about this, I don't think this has any reflection on people's attitude to NGOs or political parties more broadly. I think when people are voting no to the tune of 96% in an area, that tells you a level of deep frustration that is indicative of something significantly greater than what's specifically being offered. And so my personal opinion of what we actually witnessed here is that for the last year or two, the government has been under intense pressure on a variety of issues from the public. So, for example, our immigration policy has been hugely controversial. They've been pursuing this extremely liberal, lax policy and approach to migration, which has led to, in some instances, there's towns and villages up and down the west coast of Ireland that have seen their population more than doubled overnight by asylum intake, which is obviously an unsustainable situation, which has led to a lot of understandable frustration. And then they have their hate speech legislation, mm-hmm. and people are very upset about that. Some government senators who have been in politics a long time said that they have never received as much correspondence about a political issue as they have about the hate speech bill. So they're coming under all of this kind of pressure and scrutiny. And then my opinion is that they thought to themselves, you know what? We've had an easy time of progressive referendums in the past. We can throw one of these out there and it'll get the pressure and attention off of us for a while. We'll hold it on International Women's Day. It'll be a nice, easy win. And then we can get back and basically end this losing streak. And it ended up proving vastly more controversial than they had anticipated and totally backfired on them. And now they're shell-shocked and they don't really know what to do or where to go from here, because they only really have one answer when they're caught out on a policy, which is to try and deflect and distract with liberal froth that it really doesn't have much bearing on ordinary people's day-to-day life. It was a distraction and a diversion, and it failed so significantly that it shows people are significantly more upset with them than they would have previously realized.
So what's really interesting about this is watching the coverage, not from Gripped, and any listeners who aren't already tapped into Gripped should get all of their Irish news there. But it's been interesting, like the New York Times basically is like, voters were confused. And this is why, you know, Progressive Ireland lost so badly. There was a couple of really barn-burning headlines basically saying, you know, the voters were really too stupid to understand what was being presented to them. And I don't know how long it took. I believe both you and John McGurk kind of tweeted out the first mention of far right, which is basically the other progressive tactic, which is when we're losing, call everybody a racist. Because, you know, the only option that isn't possible is that maybe we're wrong and maybe the voters are returning our contempt for them for a change, and it doesn't feel good. And again, they won the abortion referendum by a significant margin. And this though, again, Putin would be jealous of those numbers, right? Like 96%. This is just kind of staggering. And so when you're watching the mainstream narrative, you know, in the States, I remember there was about 48 hours after Trump's election where the media was like, wow, I wonder what role we had to play in how we cover these issues. Like, maybe the Rust Belt voters are trying to tell us something, and then they got over that really quickly and moved on. Is the mainstream Irish media, have they already moved on? Have they already kind of justified this decision by claiming that the voters were confused, which of course is to set up for another one down the road that clarifies things? Or is there actually a moment of self-reflection based on the margins and based on the fact that this is the first progressive referendum in a while that they've lost?
Yeah, I think that there is not a lot of self-reflection that I've seen from the Irish media. There has been some, encouragingly, from the government itself. And we're seeing ministers and former ministers and so on coming out saying that we need to look at, for example, how representative are NGOs of public sentiment, because one of our most prominent NGOs that is the best well-funded, which kind of spearheaded this campaign, was the National Women's Council of Ireland. And it's kind of ironic and misleading to refer to them as a non-governmental organization, considering they receive 96% of their funding for their staff costs from the government. So I'm not sure what kind of non-governmental organization is basically held up entirely by the state, but that's another question. So they spearheaded this, and then obviously they were radically out of step with ordinary women on the street. And it also goes to show, when there was an exit poll done by the independent.ie, which is one of our mainstream publications here, they found that the vast majority of women were opposed to the proposed amendments. So I think the government now, of course, they don't want to blame themselves. They want to try and minimize their own culpability, and many different political factions are running for cover. But if anything good comes out of this, it will be maybe to shatter the illusion that these NGOs represent anybody but themselves, because there is this NGO industrial complex, I've heard it referred to before, that I don't know how many people are aware of this, but Ireland has an annual budget of about 100 billion euros or so. We're a fairly small country. There's only 5 million of us in the entire Republic of Ireland. And yet we have 30,000 NGO organizations, not even staff, but different groups, in receipt of about 6 billion euros a year. So it's this absolutely titanic behemoth of an industry that has enormous sway over public policy. Politicians fear them. They don't want to fall foul of them or end up on the wrong side. And so I think to have these groups receive a blow in the way they have, with the public saying, you don't represent us, you don't speak for us, I think will certainly give them pause for thought and may have some interesting consequences down the road.
What's your view on the feedback loop on public opinion and the NGOs? Because obviously, since I wrote a book on the abortion referendum and the Irish pro-life movement, I'm very interested in the question of how public opinion is actually shaped. There's an interesting book by Daryl Paul, actually published by the University Press in the States, called How America Was Brought to Same-Sex Marriage, and just lays out the cold data on the interplay between the sorts of groups you just described and the way people's views shifted. And in Ireland, obviously, there was many factors leading up to the 2018 result. And obviously, Ireland, like everybody, every other Western country, is going through a period of mass secularization. And as we move into the post-Christian age, that has all kinds of electoral and legislative results. But at the same time, the sexual revolution is sort of a government-funded astroturf in Canada, in Ireland, like everywhere else. And I always wonder if you got rid of the NGOs overnight, because in Canada, all of our abortion groups, all of our feminist groups, all of our LGBT groups, all of this is funded by the government. So, you know, when Toronto spends 4 weeks, you know, celebrating the LGBT movement with, you know, dudes and assless chaps and things like that, this is not a reflection of you know, proud spontaneity. This is an enormously expensive government-funded endeavor. And if you got rid of all of these groups, to what extent would it take at least a lot longer for public opinion to shift in your view?
You know, it kind of reminds me of there was a photo a few years back of Justin Trudeau marching as part of a climate protest, and he's waving to the crowd. And I saw somebody say, "Why are you marching? You're the guy in charge. You don't need to participate in a protest. If you want to do something, just do it." You know, and I thought that was very funny. But it does kind of go to show that you have these sort of revolutionary organizations that have these radical plans for society, and they're there. At first glance, if you were to just look at them as an external observer, you would say, wow, these guys are real grassroots activists who want to upend the system and implement all kinds of radical ideas. And in reality, they're being held up and supported almost entirely by the government.
The taxpayers, like you pay these guys.
Exactly. And not voluntarily. If they were left up to people's voluntary will, if you went to the public and said, here, you have to decide whether or not to support these groups, they would collapse and go out of business overnight. So it's a strange kind of cultural revolution that relies entirely on the state and big business and the establishment in order to perpetuate itself. But coming back to your question, what was your question? I went off on a Justin Trudeau.
Yeah. No, if you removed, if you defunded and got, or made, forced the NGOs to kind of survive on their own, to what extent do you think they're accelerating the shift in public opinion on a lot of these social issues? Because in just looking at, I'm not aware of all the details of the various NGOs in Ireland, except for the ones that worked explicitly on the abortion issue in the lead up to the 2018 referendum. But in Canada, as far back as the early 1980s, when feminism was just starting to become an establishment view, if you track the funding of all the major groups that implemented most of the major changes in our country, the taxpayers funded all of these changes. And because there's no such thing really as government money, that the government takes that money from people like us who work hard to earn it, but then they turn around and give it to people who despise our values, who then use it to lobby against the values that we live by, and that a couple of short decades ago, everybody sort of held to be the standard status quo. And so I wonder, in Ireland, like the number of NGOs you cited is really staggering. To what extent do you think they've played a role in accelerating the speed of Ireland's shift towards progressivism?
I think that what NGOs do as far as contributing to the direction the country is going is they give the government a degree of plausible deniability so that they can cover themselves when they want to implement something that they were going to do anyway. So rather than me as a political leader doing X, Y, and Z, they can go to the people and say, well, it's not my idea. I am being hounded by this council and that commission and this organization, and there's 10 different lobbying groups that represent this large section of society, and they're the ones telling me I have to do it. It would be wrong of me, it would be undemocratic of me not to listen to the Youth Network of Ireland or one of these types of organizations, because then I'm ignoring the young people, and sure, what kind of a monster would I have to be to do that? What they don't tell you is that these organizations don't really represent anybody. Most people aren't even aware they exist. And if they were, and they were to read their charter, they wouldn't have any time for it and wouldn't agree with 1% of it. And so it's all, I would say, to answer your question, I think politicians would be more reluctant to do the things that they're doing if the responsibility for it fell solely on their own shoulders. And they had to say, yeah, the reason I'm introducing transgender ideology in schools is because I believe in it. I don't want to. I think that would be significantly more controversial than them saying, well, look, I have to. It's not my idea. I'm just caving to pressure groups.
So there's a couple of threads I want to pull there, but one of the questions I was really eager to ask you, kind of watching your coverage of this unfold, is what do social conservatives or just people who think that progress is not actually their cup of tea when it comes in the form it's being served, what do they do in a system where virtually all of your major parties were in support of the referendum? Every major political party supported abortion in 2018. And with the exception of some very good independent senators that, you could reel them off in less than a minute. The people who have been standing up and stood up during the 2018 referendum and stood up now, and they've been proven correct. But quite frankly, they're a voice crying in the wilderness, right? And we badly need them. But at the end of the day, they're not leading the forces of reaction that can accrue the voters who are clearly very dissatisfied, as they indicated during these referendums. So what would you say to Irish social conservatives who have shown how pissed off they are with the establishment? But where do they go? Like, how do you vote these people out? Because it seems like these people is all of them.
Yeah, that is a big problem that a lot of people are now having to get to grips with. Because, for example, our biggest opposition party, Sinn Féin, which many people in North America might know for their role during the Troubles, and that they're seen, I think a lot of well-meaning Irish Americans and others contribute to Sinn Féin because they think, oh, this is the nationalist party. This is a patriotic party that's kind of militant, or was at one point, but that at their core, they believe in Ireland. They wrap themselves in the flag. They sing the anthem. And so they must be the good guys, as it were. And what a lot of people don't realize is that the version of Sinn Féin we're currently dealing with is significantly more left-wing than even the left-wing policies that we're seeing currently implemented on social issues, on economic issues. I mean, they're self-described socialists. They have, the way I would describe the Irish political scene and the Overton window for a foreign audience, if you want to try and help understand it, is the government we currently have is the sort of Joe Biden, Nancy Pelosi wing of the Democrat Party. And then the opposition, the guys who are trying to beat them, the Sinn Féins and so on, are like the AOC, Rashida Tlaib, those kinds of people. And that's the political range we have. And then you could count on two hands the number of people who you would in any way consider conservative or, right-leaning, even in the slightest way, and not even particularly so, just people who say, I'm not mad about abortion. I don't think we should have open borders. Those kinds of people are few and far between. So to answer your question, what should people do? I think we're probably after the next election going to see a significant increase in independence. I think it's going to be a very fragmented parliament where they'll find it very difficult to form a government because there won't be, I don't think anyone's going to win. I'll put it that way. I don't think you're going to see any of the parties coming out of it with big gains in their seats. Some of them might lose a lot. Some of them might more or less stagnate, but it'll be very fractured. And what I've been telling people to do on whatever issue is most important to them, when politicians come to your door and they knock on your door asking for your vote, don't just slam the door in their face. Don't tell them to F off. Don't say you're not voting for them. Tell them you're not voting for them, but tell them why. Tell them, I am not voting for you because you specifically support this, and name the policy or policies that you have the biggest problem with. If they keep hearing that every time they knock on the door, they're going to report that back to HQ and say, we're getting absolutely killed on this. It might be gratifying to insult a politician. It might be gratifying to, I know lots of people probably can't wait for the election to tell them what they think of them. And that's always part of the democratic process. When a politician you have contempt for asks for your vote. But I think it's more constructive to actually inform them, because what we've seen from so many of the backbenchers and rumblings of discontent within the government parties is that they're really not that ideological, most of them. There's a handful of elite, very, very fanatical woke individuals who are driving this within the parties, but most of them I'm not convinced they believe in anything at all, really. I think a lot of them got into politics because their parents were in politics, or because they wanted to open community centers and football pitches, and they're not really there to try and enforce this ideology or that ideology. And they're just going with the people who scream at them the most, namely the NGOs and these kinds of groups, and they're kind of along for the ride. So basically what I'm saying is, I think that there was a lot of people within government who could be persuaded to drop a lot of this lunacy if the incentive was there to do so, and if they realized this is jeopardizing my seat and it's not worth it. So I don't know if that answers your question, but that's sort of the way I've been telling people to approach these things.
Is there any opportunity for a handful of independents to get together and provide an alternative, or is that sort of pretty far out in the future in your view?
That's happened. There's been a couple of independents who've started the aptly named Independent Ireland Party. So they've started that, and they're trying to get people like themselves elected now. And so I'm not going to tell people how to vote or who to vote for, because that wouldn't be right. So it's up to each individual. But these are some of the more, as I say, conservative or anti-woke elements within the government are trying to do this. But I think I could see a group like that doing well. There's also AIM2, who you have one seat, one doll seat, that is Patrick Debian, who is speaking out against a lot of this stuff. He helped spearhead the successful campaign in this referendum for the no vote. So there are a few options for people to choose from, but yeah, it'll be up to individual voters to make up their minds how they want to go.
So looking at the referendum result, looking at the media coverage, looking at the response of a bunch of the folks that you guys at Gripped interviewed, who are already saying, I don't think this reflects on us at all. Like, behind the scenes, do you think that they're saying, look, guys, like, maybe we should cancel the transgender Muslim teacher recruitment program because they're not on board with everything at the moment? Or like, are they really coping by sort of feeding? What I find so interesting about progressive politicians is they'll tell the press it had nothing to do with us. The press will report it had nothing to do with them. And then they'll read the article and be like, oh, good, it wasn't us. And you sort of have this feedback loop that seals them off from the public. And thus they never really learn the lesson. And I kind of wonder what your take is on this result. Like, you think it'll be sort of a week of agonizing and they'll move past it? Or do you think this will have sort of this defeat will have a longer lasting effect on their psyches?
It will have a longer lasting effect, definitely. And there has been both reactions that I've seen within the government parties. So, for example, we did have one journalist saying that she spoke to senior members of the government who said that, oh, it was the far right and they had a big influence on the working class and yada yada. So you are having that kind of idiocy. But then I was speaking to a former government minister who's a current member of the government, and he was saying that we failed due to government arrogance. It had nothing to do with the far right. We've basically gotten too big for our boots, and this is what happened. And notably, Willie O'Dea, who is a very senior old guard member of one of the coalition parties, Fianna Fáil, he's been around forever, he's kind of a veteran politician, he said explicitly, we need to drop the woke stuff, we need to abandon the hate speech bill, we need to just move on from all of this stuff and get back to bread and butter issues. And in response to him, another TD from his same party, who's the youngest TD in that party, he's only 26 years old, he also said, I fully agree with you, we need to abandon this stuff. So when you have one of the oldest guys and one of the youngest guys, the future and the past of the party, saying the same thing, that I think is indicative that they're really starting to think about this seriously. And the last example I'll give you is one of the editors of one of our mainstream publications was on the news the other day, and he said that he was privately talking to members of the government, and they were describing it as a nightmare, an SHIT show. They were saying it's a complete and utter, they couldn't understand how could it go so badly wrong. So I think there is certainly panic behind closed doors, whatever they say publicly to the media about, oh, this is contained to just this one issue. I don't think they believe that. And I think that's becoming increasingly evident.
So in terms of the hate speech law, again, Ireland and Canada, I find mirror each other a lot in terms of like the sheer pace of the progressivism, the top-down implementation of that progressivism, and the sheer hubris of the leadership. And I suspect right now that Trudeau has seen the writing on the wall and realizes that there's a very tiny chance that he will not get completely walloped at the next election. And he's trying to ramrod a lot of legislation through, including a truly extraordinary hate speech law. And of course, you have a hate speech law that's been put forward by the government in Ireland that is equally dangerous. It's almost as if the Canadian and Irish progressives take example from each other and model each other's actions. So maybe give us like a very short detail of why the hate speech bill is dangerous. And then one of the questions I really wanted to ask you was, will this result actually give the government pause on the hate speech bill in your view, or will it encourage them to sort of ramrod it through before public outcry can get too high?
Yeah, I think for those who don't know about the Irish hate speech bill, what it's about effectively is the reason it's so controversial is because it's so incredibly vague. So one of the examples of this is it's a hate speech bill that doesn't define the word hatred. If you look at the text of the bill, it says that hate means hate on the basis of X, Y, and Z, which is, of course, a circular definition. It doesn't mean anything. So then that leads naturally to the question, how can you be convicted of a crime that you can't even define necessarily? If we don't know what robbery is, how can you convict somebody of robbery, you know? So that's a huge problem off the bat. There's other ambiguities within it. For example, it says that it protects genders other than that of male or female, but it doesn't enumerate what those genders are. And when I asked the Taoiseach, our prime minister, how many genders are there in the government's view, he said, we don't have any official position on that. He said, I'm sure that'll be figured out in the debates during the legislation, but that's kind of a matter for parliamentarians. And that was months ago, and we've still not gotten a definitive answer on that. So hypothetically, you could be convicted for being hateful to a gender that they can't define, and they can't even define hatred to begin with. So that should start to give you an idea of why people are concerned about this, that it's so open-ended and vague, it could hypothetically be applied to almost anybody for any reason at any time. So to answer your question as to whether this will give them pause, I do think it will, because this is so hugely controversial and they've already been dealt such a walloping by Friday's results. And we've got elections coming up in June. There's going to be the European and local elections. And then very shortly after that, there'll be a general election. It has to be held by next spring at the latest. So they're not going to want to walk into that with the aftermath of a disastrously unpopular piece of legislation in their wake. So my personal opinion is that this thing is dead. As much as they would love to get it through, I don't think they're going to succeed in that. But obviously, time will tell. And we'll see. The one kind of caveat I would put on that is there's a huge amount of government politicians who are retiring, like something, I can't remember the latest figure, but it was something like 14 or 15 major figures have said that they're stepping away from politics. So it is conceivable that having nothing to lose as a kind of parting gift to the electorate, they could try to launch a kamikaze attack and just go for the most hated law imaginable as they're leaving. But as I say, there's no way to tell. My instinct is that it's dead.
Kind of one final point I wanted to cover is looking at the referendum result and the two proposals that got rejected by the electorate. I'm interested in what specifically the electorate rejected. So on one hand, this is, as you mentioned earlier in this conversation, a kind of a collective backlash to elite hubris. It was kind of like, okay, the government's sort of asking us for a referendum on their values, and this is an opportunity to show them that we are not on board with the direction of the country. And so there was probably a lot of people who cast their ballot, not even on the specific question, but on the broader question of, do we like the direction that the government is taking the country? For the specifics of the question, are you encouraged by what seems to be a clear message by the Irish electorate that mothers are important, that despite the fact that we're seeing gender fluidity as an ideology infect the establishment and women being very dehumanized with all kinds of pretty appalling terminology like, you know, bleeders and you know, birthing persons and all of this sort of thing, and that this was a recognition of the fundamental role that mothers play in Irish society, and that the electorate wanted to make that clear? Or what's your sense on what the bulk of the backlash was originating?
Yeah, I think that certainly plays a big part of it, because, you know, this particular article of the Constitution is the only place where mothers are mentioned explicitly. Mm. And there's no equivalent mention for men. Men don't get a mention in the same way. Nor should they, because the people who wrote the Irish Constitution, as it was intended, were specifically trying to honor women and say that women fulfill a unique role in society that cannot be replicated by anybody else. Mm-hmm. Of course, there are men who stay home with their kids for mm-hmm. various reasons and who do good work. We all know that. We all accept that. Of course, fathers play an important role in the betterment of society. We all accept that. But this was an incredibly, in my view, and not just in my view, but in the view of some of the members of government who spoke on this in years prior, this was an incredibly progressive piece of legislation for the time when the Constitution was written in the 1930s, that said what women do for society is something that only women can do. It's not a general attitude that people who care for other people, which is what they wanted to effectively say in its place, are helpful or something. No. Women have specific niches, as do men in society, and we should honor them and we should thank them and we should be grateful for that. And so I think for them to try and remove that, not just on International Women's Day, but 2 days before Mother's Day, was a critical strategic error that certainly did not pan out the way they probably would have liked.
Final question, just for our listeners. I know I have quite a few listeners who also follow the work that you do at GRIPT. And those who have read my book on the Irish pro-life movement, Patriots, will know that one of the reasons GRIPT was created was by a substantial group of people who recognized that the Irish mainstream media was essentially a feedback loop with the progressive establishment, and that there was millions of Irish people whose voices were not actually being heard. But since then, you know, just even in conservative media circles, you see GRIPT everywhere. You know, the videos of your interactions with government ministers regularly go viral. The reporting has been phenomenal. A lot of times you guys are breaking stories that nobody else will do. So this isn't just another conservative site providing good commentary and good opinion, which is something I do all the time. GRIPT is actually like a media organization that's breaking stories, doing on the ground journalism. You're far more than just a commentary outfit. So, let us know what's been like to be on this ride, because GRIPT has obviously exploded, especially when you consider the size of your audience in a country the size of Ireland.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of amazing how far we've come in such a short period of time, that we've only been around for a couple of years. GRIPT was founded, I think, in 2019, if I'm not mistaken. So we're babies when you're considering there are organizations like the Irish Times that have been around for hundreds of years in this country. And then here we are having the impact that we're having. And I would love to say, oh, it's because we're so excellent. And of course, there are many talented people that I work with, and I really appreciate them and their insight. I honestly think that these are just cover stories that people are interested in that are not being covered by anybody else. So it's easy to be incredibly successful when you have no competition. I'll put it that way. You know, if other outlets were to try and start going into the domains that we were going in, we would have a lot harder time of it, because I do think that it's a funny situation when people are leaving tremendous stories on the table. I won't bore people with examples, but just one that people probably find funny is last year we had a case of a violent biologically male sex offender who was totally, he hadn't had surgery or anything. He had all of his male anatomy intact, as it were. And he was put into a women's prison because he identified as female, despite the threatening to rape and torture and kill women, including his own mother. So that was a situation unfolding in this country. It obviously made the news. People were talking about it. And I decided to ask our Taoiseach, our prime minister, is this person a woman in your view? Because they identify as a woman and they're in a women's prison. So what do you say? And he was totally shell-shocked. He didn't know what to say. He said, oh, I'm not too familiar with the story. I'll have to look into it. and it went viral and it got something like 3 million views and it made international headlines. But what was so significant about that was nobody else, all of these other seasoned journalists, I don't have a journalism degree. I'm not particularly bright. I'm not smarter than anybody else. I'm not more talented than anybody else. But nobody else was willing to ask the very obvious question that was on the minds of the public. And so I think that's where Gripped comes into its own, is that if we have anything going for us, it's that we are willing to go to where the people want us to go and not where we're, you know, everybody else is comfortable remaining, if you want to put it that way.
Where can our listeners find your work?
Gripped.ie, that's G-R-I-P-T, and I'm Ben Scallon, so I'm active on social media. Twitter or X is where I'm most active at the moment, but as I said, it'd be great to, if you want anything Irish related, this is the one-stop shop.
Well, thank you very much for taking the time.
Much appreciated. Great to talk to you.
Ladies and gentlemen, that was my conversation with Ben Scallon. Thank you so much for joining us this week. We're going to be having a series of interviews over the next couple of weeks before I return to my series on the impact of gender ideology on our culture. If you'd like to check out our podcast, head over to lightsightnews.com, click on the podcast tab. You can find us there and you can download these podcasts wherever you get your content. Thanks so much for listening.